Thanks very much. And thanks very much for asking me to speak today, John. I just want to talk a little bit about how I'm coming at this and how it fits with what we've been hearing about this morning. I'm really going to give you a sort of case study based on our experience at OUP of trying to make our content more accessible to people searching for it and finding it and using it. So it is a case study. It's in a way a sort of different end of the telescope from what Richard's just been talking about at a much more macro scale in terms of, you know, the cataloguing of everything, the availability of everything on the web. And just also to emphasize that I have had two roles at OUP. I have an editorial sort of responsibility, most recently for reference. In future, this summer, I'll be switching that focus back more towards academic publishing and history. But the discoverability program that we set up a couple of years ago, 2.5 years ago now at OUP, is runs right across our publishing, our academic publishing. So it ranges from science journals at one end of the spectrum through wide range of monographs and Oxford Scholarship Online, a lot of reference information, through to scholarly editions and dictionaries and things at another end of the spectrum. So I think the interesting thing about the case study for OUP is it's not a sort of monoculture in publishing terms. It's not serving a particular audience of researchers. It's ranging across the piece, and I hope that will make it interesting. Also to say that I'm not really talking about textbooks as such. Our publishing specifically for college texts, as Lorraine was talking about really principally this morning, or about downloadable ebooks. Nor am I primarily going to be talking about business models, as Brian was really talking about, but I will be talking about a lot of the stuff that Brian was talking about, because in a way, regardless of how the sustainability of the operation is provided for, and there are big shifts going on in that, whether it's the library or the end user who pays, or whether it's the authors and the research councils who pay, in the end, there is a sustainable model that has to emerge out of all of that. But the key thing is that discovery, the importance of finding that information, is there regardless of how that model works. And indeed, it's probably even more important in a world, if we do move to a world where there's a vast morass of undifferentiated information that's being pumped out at the behest of the authors and the research councils rather than selected, whether by publishers or librarians. So really we're talking about discovery and not business here. So going right back to the beginning, why did we think about discoverability in the first place? Why does it matter to all of us? This is really stating the obvious, but I want to go back to first principles here. It is the lifeblood of scholarship. That's why it matters. And in an electronic world, we can see how people are using information, we can see what they value, and we can see what more they might want to access. Very obvious. Behavior is changing so fast that the degree of change, and it's a common theme these days, but it's not just that if you can't find it, you won't use it, but people are searching for topics, which might include works, in Richard's terminology. But this is also bearing out a number that Richard was talking about, that 80% of traffic to the Oxford Journal's website, which is by far our largest sort of collective aggregation of content, is direct to the article from some other system. 50% of it comes direct from Google to a journal article. It's not going near the journal, Oxford Journal's homepage, not going near the contents list of the journal homepage, any of that stuff. Doesn't matter. Straight onto the article. And there are an awful lot of search systems. People use lots of different levels of search. The web we talk about all the time, but there are discipline-based research hubs. There are library systems we've been talking about. Vendors increasingly, there's contests for the library desktop from Discovery Services. That's another whole arena. But we've also got, as has also been mentioned today, the social web, the semantic web, people finding things through trails, not through search. A vast competition for attention, but everything comes back to data. So how were we managing our data? How were we describing our content to the world at large? Well, we'd done a number of things. And, you know, they're all good things. But when we looked at them, we found that there was an awful lot of sort of patchiness in how we were doing it. We were doing it in local areas. We were doing it in journals, or we were doing it in monographs, or we were doing it in some other area. We weren't joining it up. We weren't doing it consistently. And it was costing us an immense amount of effort to do things in lots of itty-bitty ways that didn't really add up to an overall sustainable system. So we went right back and said, well, what are we trying to do here? I mean, it's not about finding point of access. It's about where the user is on the web when they may or may not come across a link to our content. So again, right back to the sort of fundamental principles, this will be familiar to people here, but it's worth recapping. So where does discovery happen? Where are users on the web? Well, they're an open web search, but there are lots of varieties of open web search. And we need to feed them all. There are library services we've talked about. We've talked about research hubs, obviously, PubMed, Social Science Research Network, lots of others. They can be there. They can be following links. An immensely important way of discovering content is simply following the footnotes, following the references. There are lots of other ways that people come across content. They opt in to table contents alerts, to bookmarking, social bookmarking, and so on. There's lots of viral awareness these days, as we well know. OUP runs a number of websites which can offer ways of linking to content. But out of all of those, we're looking for a moment where there's a link or a listing placed in front of a reader. And if they can go through to the full text, we want them to do that as soon as possible. That's the royal road. That's what we want them to do. If we do our linking right, then they'll find lots more content through the references, through the footnotes. And what we get from that is recorded use. And we get it as publishers, we get it as librarians. That's a big outcome of that. That's the outcome of the discovery process. We're not measuring this in terms of money. But whenever people don't authenticate, when they can't access the content for one reason or another, and bear in mind OUP does operate quite a number of open access journals and other things, we still want them to find something. We want them to find an abstract or piece of free content. This is second nature in journals. Has been from before the digital age, ANI services in print and so on. It hasn't been true of a lot of the rest of our content until recently. We can offer them lots of free content. We can offer them access to the full text, but mostly we can offer them ways through to find access to the full content, whether it's circulating a print copy in a library, pay-per-view, finding another way to access it through an e-book. So there are other forms of access. If we do all of this well, we can offer, you know, there are lots of services that we can offer on the top of it, all of which, with our content linking, should provide the routes for further discovery. But what's driving all of this, at the very beginning of this, how do we seed all of these systems with the description of the content in the first place? Because without that, none of it happens. So we stood right back and we said, okay, across all of our publishing, our academic publishing, how can we provide a more consistent raft of information for people to see and use? So we put together a program called the Oxford Index, which does several things. But the three or four main things that we're talking about here is just bringing together a standardized description of every item of content in one place. It's exactly what Richard was talking about on a far larger scale. But it's a start for us just to do it within our own domain. If we can do that, then at least we can provide all that information to external search partners, whether that's Summon or EDS or a library or OCLC or whoever needs it. So there will be a consistent set of content described in the same way. If we're going to do that and give it to everyone else, we may as well have an interface onto it ourselves and offer that interface. It will at least provide landing pages for every item of content that we publish. And it's at item level, not work level or book level. So it's every article, every reference entry, every chapter, etc. So we can offer quick pathways to full text if you don't have access to it, and we can make it web searchable, we can expose it to Google, and it enables you to cross-search Oxford books and journals for the first time. So that was a step forward for us. But most importantly, I think in the longer term future, the first two things on here are infrastructure, if you like, the getting the cataloging together, getting the distribution, the exposure of that to web search together. The long-term use of it is going to be through creating links and relationships across content, which is very similar to what Richard's been talking about. Meaningful links add value, they add use. We've evolved a set of hundreds of thousands of overview pages so far, which are free to air, which are a form of a kind of knowledge graph in a very specific and contained way within OUP content. We're giving away free reference information about a concept, whether it's John Milton or influenza or hyperinflation or whatever it may be. We give away a free piece of reference content, and then the aim is to offer links to every item of content that OUP publishes that is related to that topic. Those overview pages enable us then to link our content with any other system which is using a topic-based approach to linked data. So it provides a gateway into our system to which we can add lots of bits of content as we go on evolving our publishing, but it provides a road into our content from outside, wherever that outside may be. And we embed these links directly in the products. Most importantly, it's a free service. Two important words. It is free. It's free to people who want to use the information in their own systems. It's free to use on the web. But we integrate that data with existing products. This is really a joke. This is an internal map of some of the things we had to do to try to get this together. This is actually now completely outdated. It's far more complicated than this, really. But you can see there's Onyx in there, there are XML repositories, there's a file system, there's all kinds of rubbish going on here. Now, if we were starting now, we wouldn't start from here, would we? No, we'd start from the other end. We'd start from, what do the search engines need? Well, they need schema.org. How much more detail do we need to add to that? Well, yes, we can go down to Marc. We know libraries want Marc, so we provide it. But actually, that's the way we'd start. We'd say, what do the search engines need for discovery? So what does this mean as we look at our existing? Because our sites, some of them are extremely well-ranked. Oxford Journals is getting masses of traffic from Google. We don't have a problem in some areas of our publishing. So what does this new initiative mean, actually, for our existing search rankings and usage? Well, we see no change in existing SEO or Google PageRank happening as a result of the index's existence. It's a supplementary route to the full text if the site where the full text lives doesn't happen to come up high in Google results. And we are dealing with some legacy sites which have a much more closed architecture than we would now use. And indeed, I've just recently been responsible for taking Oxford Reference, which is our general reference service, which was a completely closed site. You couldn't even search it unless you had a subscription. To a completely open site where you can search everything, and it's the content, the full content, which is the paid-for element. But again, the business model may change, but the architecture is right. The finding the stuff is free, and what happens after that, how you then access it, is dependent on all kinds of factors that actually we don't control as publishers. We fit in with. But what the index does do is give Google a sort of super site map to tell them that all these sites are indeed the same sort of trusted network of information, whether they're called anb.org for the American National Biography or oed.com or oxfordjournals.org or some other site. And they're all part of the same now. They're all linked to from the index, and Google can see those connections in this sort of super site map. And our aim, as I said before, is to add use. I mean, because in the end, use drives everything else that we do. As I said, whatever the business model, at the end of the day, if it's not being used, it's not being useful, and particularly as a university press, that's our primary concern. Sustainability has to be part of it, but the primary concern is dissemination. So what does this mean for library visibility? Well, our aim is to bring more users into library-owned or library-distributed or library-sponsored content from general web search. We've put in interactions directly with library systems into the Oxford Index interface so that we hope people will be able to see their holdings, see what they have full text access to by visiting the index. We're reading IP addresses and so on and matching them to our credentials and offering a filter by full text access. And we're offering searching back into library systems from Oxford Index pages directly so that you could, say, search back into the library's discovery service from the index. However, we are continuing to distribute all of the metadata that we provided before in rather bitty and not very well organized ways. We are routinely supplying that to library systems, whether it's individual libraries or library vendors. But I hope in a much more regular and better managed way and across the whole piece. So just to sum up, what we're doing here really is we're creating a hub of metadata. The REST interface is onto it, but the heart of this is actually the metadata. Every item, it contains all our links, it contains these overview pages which express relationships between items of content and offer substance as well in terms of free reference content. We're doing a lot of linking work to extend the links and to link what we can offer to all of the outside world, whether it's through DBpedia or any of the marvelous linking systems that Rich has talked about, which we're working on very actively at the moment. First thing we can do is we can offer this to external search partners, really to library systems, but ultimately also to Google. We use exactly the same data in our websites as we're creating in the metadata hub. The same data goes out to those sites, those individual websites that serve the full text content, such as Oxford Reference. And we're also offering our own web interface so you can cross-search all of the metadata. We're also providing now, across a lot of our online products, a bar where you can bring up a set of related content within Oxford Reference, say, which allows you to not only to enter from the wider world, but when you're within Oxford content, to find other related Oxford content within each product. That's the broad idea. Benefits, well, we've talked about widening use. Consistency. It's not just a question of neatness. Consistency, whether it's in terms of navigation and user experience, whether it's in terms of access methods, how the websites behave, the business methods and the interfaces, or just the common data fields, if we can do that across all of our content. We had things indexed in so many different ways. You would not believe the differences that we discovered between our journal indexing and our indexing of things like the Dictionary of National Biography, where it was completely, completely different. But as I keep saying, most importantly, it's this evolving grid that we can offer of options to connect content. We have applied a taxonomy, for example, for the first time at an item level across the content that we publish in our academic business. We want to make it better, but it's a start. And we can connect to external standards, whether it's ORCID for author names or whichever author identifier comes along, LC name authority file, etc. And we can connect to these external standards and continue to do so in the future, driven by whatever is coming along in the market and the user's requirements. So lessons learned, well, can we put everything in one place? That was the promise of this program. The simple mantra was, it's a free service and it has everything in one place. But actually putting everything in one place across a business as diverse as OUP, even across in one publisher, I hate to think what goes on in the back offices of OCLC, but even within one publisher, getting everything in one place was really, really challenging. And you realize how many silos exist even within one publishing house. It has been a pilot about all kinds of cross-divisional development, cross-platform development. The data model, where it had to be a common data model, mapping user interfaces across multiple sites has been interesting. Everything listed here, the taxonomy, the problems we have with access control. We have different access control systems for different kinds of product and content. It's mad. We couldn't duck any of these things in the way that they've been ducked in the past. And that was the point, sticking to this matter of everything in one place. And last but not least, this is a big experiment. As other people have said, today, we have to approach this with an open mind. This is a sort of virtual platform for us, but we're learning every day about what people are doing and wanting from it. And the where we end up is likely to be somewhere different from where we anticipated when we started out. But the important thing is to stay open-minded and keep learning. So how are we doing? I've been looking recently particularly at year-on-year stats from January 13 against the previous January. 2012 was a year in which we got the data out there and it started to be indexed and we were adding to it right through the year. It wasn't until the autumn really that we achieved a kind of critical mass with some of our reference data and our medical data and further back issues of journals coming online. So we've been releasing things progressively through this year. So it's been a very interesting year to look at. We're seeing some really interesting things. First of all, reasons to be cautious. These are web usage statistics. You know, be very careful with them. They are really, really slippery things. They are counter-compliant, but there are all kinds of other things going on here. We've had a lot more libraries signing up for access to our content. That's been going on. There have been marketing initiatives going on around web search. Lots of other things going on, apart from the inherent difficulties of looking at web stats. So there are reasons to be cautious. However, we are seeing some very strong patterns which do cause us to be cheerful. Total visits to our online content products are up by 44% in that year. And I'm going to boil that. That includes some very big sites like Oxford Journals, which is up 20% over the year. Our free dictionary service, which had use doubled in the course of the year. And these two are both massive numbers, many, many millions of visits a month. The OED is also a rather special factor. It's been out there for a long time. It has an immense amount of direct access, and it's not included in the Oxford Index. So I've sort of excluded that in looking at like-for-like data. But just basing this on sites that were there for 12 months and had stats in January 12 and stats in January 13, what we've been looking at there are that our total visits are up by more than 50%. Our visits for Google are up by nearly 2.5 times over the year before. And as a percentage of our total visits have gone up from something like 12% to about 28% in the course of the year. Now, we're expecting to see that increase go on. These are sites which also have quite a lot of direct traffic because they're quite highly bookmarked. They've got quite a lot of loyal users. Add in the direct traffic, and we're now looking at, that's about a quarter. So we're now looking at more than half our traffic to this quite wide range of online content sites coming from Google and direct. So that's broadly speaking how we're doing with this. And I think I'm just going to put up a final slide just to punt a few ideas out there about where we see some of the trends in discoverability moving from now on. I'm not going to go through those in detail because they shoot off in lots of different directions, like sort of random fireworks, but something just to contemplate. I think that's where I'm ending. So rather than leave a blank slide with the obvious word questions on it, I'll put that one instead.
Take us into some very new avenues, and sounds a fascinating project, and one which is obviously generating a lot of interest. Questions?
Penny Bailey from Bailey Solutions. I'm interested in this linking thing, and perhaps this is a question for Richard. How do you manage links to external content? Because they could change.
Well, I mean, I think Richard will probably answer this in a far better way than I can, but the essential idea is for us that we isolate a thing, as Richard was saying, that we isolate a topic, and then we have lots of bits of content that refer to that topic, and we will go on adding bits of content that refer to that topic, and there'll be lots of other bits of content out there in the rest of the world which relate to that topic. But the important thing is the link. It's the name authority file. And if you like, I mean, in that particular world, in that particular context, if we can have a single concept of that thing, then we can say, well, if you want information from us on Shakespeare or hyperinflation or, you know, whatever it is, here is a landing point. And we'll have all these trails going off from that concept.
Yeah, but if that link to Shakespeare is changed by the provider of it, how do you manage that?
If you don't mind me butting in.
Yes, yes.
You use identifiers from authoritative sources. So somebody like VIAC will not change the URI for Shakespeare.
Yeah.
It's part of their contract with the world, if you like.
Okay.
The Library of Congress will not change the URI for the subject of libraries in their subject headings. So you start relying on those authoritative identifiers.
The whole thing goes back to
If you link to Google information, for example, I mean, Google always changing things.
Yeah, but they're not publishing authoritative identifiers.
Right.
Well, we would link to. The key there is to link something like DBpedia, which is one of the ways in which Google derives information for the knowledge graph. I mean, they actually did it from, they bought a company called MetaLab, I think, 2 or 3 years ago now. That was the sort of basis of knowledge graph, which started to come out about a year ago. And but it is based on linked data which exists, as Rich says, on the basis of persistent identifiers. You have to have those persistent identifiers. For me, this interest goes way back to when we kicked off the rewrite of the Dictionary of National Biography in 1992. We didn't know about the web, we did know about databases, we did know about SGML, we knew about the OED electronic version that had already come out by then on CD-ROM. But we also knew that the Dictionary of National Biography had been used as a name authority in lots and lots of cataloging and archiving. We also knew that we were going to change it. We were going to change names, we were going to change dates. But, you know, the person who's in the old DNB is Mary Ann Cross. Was going to be in the new DNB as Marion Evans, and will be in any literature library under the name of George Eliot. But those are all the same person. And so, actually, it was from that moment on we started planning on this basis of having sort of solid persistent identifiers, which then flowed naturally into lots of ways of managing our data and systems. So it's the same principle. You don't change the identifier, even if you
right.
add links to it, or you change the display name, or you change whatever.
Okay, Richard.
One quick question. This is all great in delivering services to the outside world. What benefits have you seen internally now you've built it?
Well, we're looking partly at how we refer users across products. So if somebody visits Oxford Scholarship Online, which is our main monograph site, would they know that there was a handbook chapter on exactly the topic that they were looking at, which gives you a wonderful map of advanced research in that area? Would they know, would they have a quick route from, we've published a new site of Oxford Scholarly Editions, which really capitalizes on what you were talking about in terms of the idea of a work. You know, we have works, and then we have editions of those works. But one of the key links there is always going to be, well, how do we get to the DNB biography of this person? So we're seeing a growing rate of referral from within the product. So that's from the users and the sort of publishing point of view. In the sort of back office and in lots of other ways, we're seeing a huge range of advantages in this. We use standard metadata across sites for development purposes. We share links. That's one of the other things. All the linking we were doing before was local. It was within one service, within the DNB, or between the DNB and, say, Grove Music and Oxford Handbooks. But all that information was kept within that single silo and never really shared. But there's no reason why, if you create a link, if you know that Picasso is related to Cubism, and you know that because there's a cross-reference in Grove Art that says that, or in the box of reference, general reference. There's no reason why that link shouldn't be available to every item of content we've got on Picasso or Cubism anywhere in the system, every journal article and whatever. So that pooling, storing, sharing, enhancing, reusing links, that's a huge engine for future usability, I think, for the reader. But it also simplifies, but should simplify our system. Obviously, creating the infrastructure to do it is a challenge. But it's that thinking across, I mean, I think fundamentally, psychologically, the change has been thinking across everything that we publish and not, it's my bit, you know, this is the textbook of medicine, that's all I'm going to be thinking about. It's sort of lifting the view to think, you know, to think like the user, not as somebody who's got to get this particular product out.
Very similar to processes that have been going on in universities as well, I think. Yeah. One last question? No? Well, okay. Thank you very much,
Robert.